Hey, this is Sunny. As you know, if you're listening to this, you're listening for free on the free iTunes feed or whatever. So I would say that you should sign up for the Patreon, not just because you get the episodes, early. You get them before you hear them here, but because we're gonna start having some stuff that's just exclusively over there forever. For instance, today, this week on Monday, we published a ranking of all the MCU movies. It's 36 minutes of ranking goodness. You're going to love it. And you should go listen to it over there. We're going to do a couple times a month stuff that will never be on this feed. So if you love the show and you want to support it and you want to get things early and you want to hear things that you're not going to be able to hear over here, you should sign up for the Patreon. So go to subbeacon.com and sign up there. It's subbeacon.com. You can, as little as a dollar a month or as much as one Jeff Bezos spaceship a month. We'll take one of those every month and sell it for scrap or something. So anyway, sign up at the Patreon, and it'll be great and you'll enjoy the show. You'll get it early. You'll get exclusives. You'll get all sorts of comment sections. You love comment sections. Gotta get it. So, okay.
Celebrity chef Wolfgang Puck.
People knew who owned the restaurant. They rarely knew who did the cooking.
Wolf brought the chef into the limelight.
You know what you have to fight.
When Wolf opens Spago, he's serving this very simple food that's incredibly flavorful.
Celebrities loved going there. Choice 1, 2, and 3 was Spago.
Wolf got to know all the movie stars. The age of the celebrity chef had begun.
Everything was a huge success. But I asked myself, who am I?
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Subbeacon. I'm Victor Mattis, along with Jonathan V. Last and Sonny Bunch. Just a reminder, the Subbeacon is now available through Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com. You'll easily find us. Tell your friends. Please subscribe. And don't forget about the Subbeacon merchandise store at tpublic.com. Gentlemen, how are we? JVL, Sonny, we're all back together now.
Hey. Yeah, it's been a couple weeks.
How was last week's show?
Good show.
Good show.
KSA.
Good.
Filled in for you admirably. No quadrants. Did you go see the movie so you can give us a quadrant rating?
Oh, thank God I did not. I just cannot write. And I think I might have weaseled out of the last one, but I can't remember if I did or didn't. There's one of these movies that you guys always do, and I keep on finding ways to sneak, and it's like I have yet to see it. I might have seen F8, I think. But it's like you have to actually, see all of them. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's like family.
You skipped Hobbs and Shaw, I think.
I think
you saw Fate of the Furious, but you skipped Hobbs and Shaw.
I saw the one where they go back to the Rocks Island and his Polynesian family is there.
Oh, that is Fate.
Okay. No, that's Hobbs and Shaw.
That's Hobbs and Shaw. Yeah, I saw that.
Mm. Yeah, who could say? Yeah, maybe you're right.
Rampage is the one I never saw. And you think that I saw it, but I never saw it. Okay. JVL, what's going on?
Are you interested in a Flash update?
Sure.
From his tournament. So I taped last week's show from the La Quinta Inn in Salisbury, Maryland. And
that's how you pronounce it. That's correct.
After the first night, we switched hotels. I couldn't live like that anymore. And the mold on the ceilings and it was very bad.
It's a La Quinta. How could that be?
This was a bad La Quinta. And upon checkout, the front desk clerk was very apologetic and said, don't worry, we'll only charge you for the first night. And then 2 days later, I got my email folio from La Quinta, and they charged me for 4 nights. Great. Yeah. So I got to get on the phone with La Quinta and argue, and I'm sure they'll tell me that, like your gym, Sonny, you have to travel to the state where you were staying in order to dispute the charges.
But also, though, you were there... during the stay that you had booked, right?
Right.
I'm sure there's some sort of cancellation policy where you have to cancel 48 hours in advance, mm-hmm. otherwise you're just charged
for
everything.
I'm sure. You know what? Even if they wind up charging me for everything, it was worth it not to stay in that dump. And I will return to Twitter just to shit all over La Quinta if they don't make it right.
Did you stay at a better place then?
We stayed at a Country Inn and Suites that was clean. So yes, it was
better. That's all you want. Yes.
It was better. It was clean. That's all I care about. So, so Flash's team won their pool. The way these tournaments work is you have pool play, and then you go to, depending upon how you finish, you either go to the good bracket or the loser bracket. They went undefeated in pool play, went to the good bracket, the gold bracket as the 3 seed, and pulled a very, very tough draw. Pulled probably the second best team, a team that was down from Arcadia, New York, I think, or Arcade, New York, someplace up in New York State. And this might have been the best travel team I have yet seen in our 3 years. They were very good. The coaches started one of the other kids, and he gave up 3 runs in the first inning. And then in the second inning, he put runners on the corners with only 1 out, and then they came in and went to Flash. And over the next 5 innings, he struck out 11, allowed 1 earned run, 3 hits. That's how good this team was. They got 3 hits off of Flash in 5 innings. And then we get to the bottom of the 6th inning, Flash's team trailing by 1, and Flash homers to tie it.
Oh my gosh.
After which we learned that in tournament baseball, the rules are the first person to score in extra innings wins.
What?
Which is the most ridiculous thing maybe ever.
Yeah.
That's not
how baseball works.
That is not how baseball works.
So in other words, the other team does not get a chance at the bottom.
Correct.
Makeup.
Correct. Which means that if you're the visiting team,
you have a very large advantage. It's like those weird NFL tie-breaking things where if you can, overtime games where if you can run all the way down on the first play, you win or something like that, right?
Isn't
that how that works?
Yeah. But so anyway, in the 7th inning, the third baseman makes an error, so a runner reaches first and then steals a base, then scores on a pass ball. All that matters is, as I was ranking the best possible outcomes for this tournament, the best outcome was that they win the whole thing. The second best outcome was that they lose the first game.
Because
then you could just leave. Yeah. Right. The worst thing you want was, because if they had made it all the way to the championship game, mm-hmm. we would not have left Salisbury, Maryland until 9 p.m., would not have arrived in New Jersey until 1 in the morning. It would have been absolutely horrible.
That's brutal.
And as it was, their game at 7 a.m. was done at 9, and we were able to just get out
on
the road. Done.
Very nice.
It was great.
Very nice.
11 Ks. It was dominant.
Giddy up. Why didn't they just play him? Why didn't they just pitch him to start?
Well, so this is... in tournament play... Being the visiting team, which is a coin flip, right? So the two coaches, meet up and they flip a coin to decide who's going to be the visitor and who's going to be the home team. And the winner of the coin flip gets to choose. And being the visitor is an enormous advantage because you get to bat first and see if you get any runs on the board. And if you do, then you can decide which pitcher you want to go to first.
Oh, you don't have to have
your lineup does not have to be started. You can make a decision, especially when you have to play in tournament play 3 games in 1 day. Everything is about scarce resources in pitching,
yeah.
right? So you have 18. You have to get through 18 innings of a game, where the games are progressively harder, and so in theory, you want to hold your best pitchers till late. Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And also, as it turns out, it's a big advantage to the visiting team because if you wind up tied at the end of the 6th inning, you can walk it off at the top of the 7th. So
that's great. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's insane. I don't understand how that can be how it works.
Yeah, it's not because it's not actually baseball. But then tournament play isn't baseball, right? There is no world of baseball in which you play round robin and then go into single elimination. And you play 3 games in a single day. It's only in this cockamamie. But, there were teams from Ohio, teams from Washington State.
Oof.
And I got to tell you, If our coaches came to us and said, hey, we'd like you to book cross-country plane tickets so that your 12-year-old boys could go play baseball, I would say, I don't think so.
I know lots of people who do.
Who would do that?
They'll drive down. Believe me.
It's one thing to drive across the state. It's one thing to go from New Jersey to Maryland or, you know, D.C. to even like North Carolina or something, right?
If it's once a year. Like, for a once a year big regional tournament, that's fine. But even that is a little much, right? Saying like, hey, you got to spend $700 on hotel rooms for this stupid tournament.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big ask, I think.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, I like the whole travel world. My parents were like, you can play rec. We'll buy you tennis lessons, but you are not doing
middle states.
You're not going on one of these travel middle soccer states. Teams. And I was a decent soccer player, having like spent 4 years in England, like playing soccer with real soccer players. It was a thing that I could have done, and I am so glad that they put the foot down and was like, no travel soccer for you.
You played soccer after being in England and you came to the United States, when you played soccer, did you say a lot of, oi, oi, did you say that a lot?
Oi. Yeah, I dropped the C word a lot, which was not appreciated in the Florida rec leagues.
Ah, you balmy. The
U10, U10 rec leagues, they're like, oi. Look at this Guy Ritchie wannabe. He's got a movie that's going to come out in 10 years, and everyone's going to talk about how he uses the C word in it. And this is the kid.
And you were ahead of your time. Yes. Sonny, what's going on with you?
Not much. I have a tuxedo shirt update. We discussed tuxedo shirts on the last episode.
Why do you?
Because I was wearing I was trying to decide between the peak front shirt, you know, with like the kind of textured. Or the traditional pleated. I ended up going with the traditional pleated that I actually wore to my wedding 10 years ago. I wore the wedding tux. But the only reason this happened was because, so I bought this new shirt because I wasn't 100% sure that the shirt from my wedding was going to survive the dry cleaning process. If people remember, it was a bit of a disaster. And I put the shirt on, the new shirt, the new pick front short peak. Is it peak? P-I-Q-U-E, peak?
Peak.
Peak.
Peak, yes. Peak. Peak.
I put it on and I tried it on when I bought it, you know, it fit. I was like, all right, great. And then it's a slightly slimmer cut of shirt than the other shirt that I have. The first time that I went to put my jacket on with like the little pips, you know, the little... Uh-huh. They all four of them just flew off, just popped right off. I was like, oh, that's not gonna, because when I tried it on with the detachable buttons, you know, it like the detachable mother of pearl buttons,
the studs.
It, like fit fine. Yeah. No, the studs were what I put on when I was like putting the actual tux on. Mm-hmm. And when I when I flexed out to put my jacket on, just
that's
like,
what you want to call it.
Like. Well, I mean, you know what I mean? Like when I expanded my rib cage, they flew off like they were shot out of a gun. Yeah. And I was like, well, that's not great.
Wow.
Bob. So I ended up going with the pleated front shirt, which again, from my wedding still fits perfectly. It is not quite as a slim a cut as these new fangled what these kids are wearing today.
No, the new
2021.
It's too thin now. All the suits, everything models against these Europeans that are very tight.
Yeah, that's
very
the problem.
Narrow people.
The cuts are much thinner. We haven't gotten older and fatter.
No. They're very narrow people. They're very narrow people now.
Well, no. It was so I when I ordered the shirt, I was talking to a guy from the store. I was like, hey, I wear this cut shirt from Brooks Brothers. I wear a 15-5 collar, 33 arms in the like slim whatever it's called now, the Regent.
Vic is like that too. He wears a 33 collar.
I'm a 17 and a half. Sorry, I'm a 17 and a half, 18 really comfortably, but 17 and a half, but a 33. So basically kind of like a Shrek size dimension here, with like neck versus arm. Okay.
Yeah.
So.
So, and I'm talking to the guy from, it's Bonobos, you know, the...
Yes,
the,
Bonobos. The
you bought I'm a like, tux shirt from Bonobos?
Yeah, and I was like, hey, guys, this is the shirt that I wear for Brooks Brothers. I wear, you know, the slim cut, the region fit or whatever. I know Bonobos is a little bit slimmer, but is it fine? And they were like, well, what's your height and weight? And I tell them. And they're like, oh, yeah, you'll be fine. This shirt's not that slim. Our slim cut's not that slim. The fucking lie. What that was.
Why did you choose to buy from formal wear from Bonobos, which is like a beach kind of brand?
No, it's not. That's not right. Mm-hmm. That's not.
No, they're not like a beach casual. Oh, Martha's.
It fits well.
It's like modern office wear. Yeah. It's like
also his jacket and pants are from Tommy Bahama. But
yeah, well, I mean, this was the wedding was on a beach. So I don't know. I don't understand what JBL's problem.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So anyway, ended up going with the pleated call again. The shirt that I got married in. So hopefully it will bring my friend Brandon and his lovely new bride lots of luck, as it has brought me and my bride lots of luck over the years. Good. So
hey, Victorino,
JBL,
how was Bahaba?
Oh my gosh, it was a mob scene. So we ended up going to Northeast, which our friend Robert Messenger said, don't even try to go to Bar Harbor. It's going to be a mess. And it was. It was like, I don't know, it felt like Mardi Gras down there. I mean, it was like Bourbon Street. It was insane. Also, we were in...
What is Bar Harbor?
That's in Maine. And that is down east Maine. It's on the peninsula.
Yeah, like Bourbon Street, where everybody is white and nobody's net worth is under $5 million.
No, you should have seen this. It was like everybody was there. Everybody was there, and it was like you couldn't get on the street. So,
how many people of color did you see in Bahaba?
I think, well, counting myself, like, and my kids can count as one because they're two, but they're half. So, you know, like two of us.
That's how it works.
But there were a lot of
a 3/5 rule, yes, if you will.
Yes, that's like. The Bar Harbor was like, I don't know. My impression of it was like, So it was not fancy at all. Whereas Northeast, which is a different town, that was very fancy. So I just turned around. I can't even get parking down here. So, I mean, it was just a mob scene. And we went up and there was just a ton of tourists. There was just a ton of tourists. And it was during this heat wave in Maine, which never has a heat wave. And it was hot and it was humid. And of course, because it's hot and humid and nobody in Maine has air conditioning. That's the insane, because they don't need it. So this was, it was like 88 degrees and it was humid. And so made it up to drove up to Cadillac Mountain, which was great in Acadia. And that was beautiful. But on our way down, it was all of a sudden everybody just showed up. And, you know, there was just people just, you know, and there's no ropes. So it's like you could fall off a cliff. And that's the end of you. And there were Chinese tourists. I felt very uncomfortable with that. I'm just going to say, because, you know, where did they come from? How did they get here? And thank God they had masks outside. I don't care. It's outside. I don't know where you're from. You know, they might, you know, you know, direct flight from Bangor to Wuhan. I don't know. It's very, very uncomfortable for me. So I said, we got to get out of here, kids.
They're probably from Marblehead.
Yeah,
you know, no, it's Chinese tourists.
No, I mean, there's like buses. I mean, everything. Everybody gets bussed in, and it was just insane. So that part was insane. It was great to see our friends, the Messengers, and the Eastlands. And Terry is doing well. It was nice to see Terry and Jill. And a highlight.
Did they move up there?
They did. They did to be close to the Grands. And
that's
casual. That's a little... Very few people will appreciate that. Very few people will appreciate
that
line, JBL.
Like 15 listeners.
And I said that several times on the trip, by the way. And to Terry. And we had dinner at that. It was just lovely. And they live in Castine, and that is very nice. And actually, you know who I saw there in Castine was Mark Salter, Small World of Small Worlds. But the highlight for me, my son and I went lobstering on a boat with the great Linda Greenlaw, the captain, the swordfish captain portrayed in The Perfect Storm by Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Does she look just like Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio?
At the time, she probably did, but she's like in her 60s now. That was a long time ago, that movie, in The Perfect Storm. But she was very cool. And she's written like, I don't know, 9 or 10 books. So, of course, eventually I came up to her later on and told her, oh, you know, I'm a writer myself. And she says, and I've been reading her book, The Hungry Ocean, which is a terrific book. And she says, oh, well, you know, as I say, I mean, what you guys do, I mean, that's really hard work. And I said, yes, it is. Yes, it is. And she says she'd much prefer sword fishing out in the Flemish. She's been to the Flemish Cap, and she says that's much easier than sitting down and writing. And so far, I felt vindicated.
So is she, what's her dealings? Is she just like...
She's now retired, so she does charters.
She takes tourists out.
Yes, she takes tourists out, her and a first mate, Keith. And you go out, they have lobster traps, and my son hauled them up, and you got to go in, grab, take out all the excess that's not lobsters. So we're talking about stone crabs, which I did not know were in harbor, in Blue Hill Harbor. Stone crabs, flounders, spiky fish, eels, you name it. And then he was able to take the lobsters, and they taught him how, wearing gloves, obviously they all wear gloves, and how to check if it's male or female, if you have to throw it back. You do the measuring thing with the little ruler that they have, and then you put the rubber bands on the claws, and you dump them in. I did all the video. That's all. That was my job.
Do you get to take the crabs home, or is this just
No, labor? This is just... This
you're
just
working.
Free,
you're,
exactly.
Like you is, pay money this is, this, to go
that's
and
right.
work on this lobster ship?
That's right. And to get... Because he wanted to go lobstering.
This is why nobody should ever go anywhere. Nobody should ever go on any vacations
I was thinking about
ever,
you.
Because this
sorry,
is the biggest
was,
scam
I was
I've
thinking,
ever heard.
I was thinking about you.
We can
you.
Get these dumb rich people to give us money to come on
it
our
is,
boat and
it is
and
you pay
put,
for
put
the ex-
lobsters
you pay for
in buckets
you, you,
for us?
Yeah, you put them inside, put them in the tanks. You put them in the tanks. It was very exciting for my son. He wants to now be a lobsterer, and he prefers that over reading. And I thought maybe we can do the same where we can pay people to have like a guest editing thing. You know, just for the experience of like editing,
where people could pay you. Well, that's what
I mean.
Are, really,
I bet if you talk to your wealthier readers, you can find all sorts of people who'd be willing to pay in order
to be a guest edit.
Or
guest
or
editors
guest
never
writer.
Edit; they write. You ever notice people
or to
say,
be a
"Oh,
guest writer"?
Yes, that is a completely different
I
experience.
Have some thoughts yeah. I'd like to tell you.
Oh, we've done that. I think we did that. There was somebody you remember. What was his name? Patterson. At the Weekly Standard.
Oh,
do you remember
boy,
that? That was insane. That's right. So we do have the equivalent of that. Anyway, but that was it. And the other experience I had was, of course, I was wearing, you know, to go hiking, I was wearing my new hiking sandals, Chacos. I got Chacos, and I was very excited until all of a sudden, on my left foot, right around the time we were up in Castine, I developed this terrible swelling in my left foot from the Chacos. And I was like, I hear that noise. What is that? These damn Chacos. And I was like, I said, you know, the straps are too tight and it's caused me to feel like I broke my foot. Or now it may be, I think I sprained it on one of the hikes, you know, in Acadia. And then it was Kate who said, I don't think that's a sprain. I think that's, yes, gout.
Was it the lobster?
Yeah, I think it was because my right foot.
How much lobster did you eat on this trip?
Okay, so it normally goes in my right foot. That was the weird thing. It was in my left foot, and it was not by the big toe, but by like at the base of the middle toes. I actually did not have that much lobster. I had a lobster roll, but then I had fried haddock. And then I had seafood pasta at the Eastlands. And then I had
76 oysters.
I had whole belly clams, which I'm a sucker. I love whole belly clams fried. And
what's the difference between whole belly clams and other sorts of clams?
They're not. The whole belly clam is whole, right? They
the
don't
whole
cut
belly
them up.
Clams have, you know, they have all sorts of problems down in Appalachia and opioid abuse. And you have to really understand the whole bellies.
The whole bellies. Oh, okay. That makes sense.
You need a Yale-trained lawyer to really explain the whole bellies to you.
So I got the whole belly clam, which was delicious. But sure enough, it was a gout because that was the... But I blamed it on the Chacos.
Wait, so did you have the eruption at the top of the mountain? Like
no, when we got out of... I was driving. You have to drive everywhere around there. And I got it when I got out of the car when we went to visit Jill and Terry. and all of a sudden I'm hobbling. If there was a race between me and Terry, he would have won. I'm just going to put it to you that way.
It was pretty bad then. Did you have your bracelet on?
Yes, I had to press the alert, but they don't go there. So then mysteriously the next day, it began to subside. And then 2 days later, it was okay. And then I was back in Arlington running. But I tell you, I love the seafood up there and the lobster and the clams. And they put that on everything in rolls and sandwiches and platters. The only thing they don't do is put on a pizza. They only do that in California. Speaking of which, this week we're talking about the documentary Wolfgang over on Disney Plus. Sonny, how about a big boy review?
So this documentary on Disney Plus about Wolfgang Puck is 75 minutes long. And I mention that because it is not nearly as in-depth as I would have liked it to have been on all sorts of different facets of Wolfgang Puck's life. I mean, it's very much a movie about, like, Wolfgang Puck grew up and he had an abusive stepfather, and he has been running from that ever since, you know, into the arms of food and into... his massive success is kind of couched as this attempt to escape from his abusive stepfather, his unhappy family, et cetera, et cetera. And it does a lot of things that I don't like when documentaries do them, like recreating scenes of children running for no reason. It's like he talks about, you know, running and running, and then we see a little...
I thought that was actual, like, footage of him as a kid.
Video footage of some random kid running. It's like, okay, I know what a child running looks like. I don't need a visual manifestation of it on the screen. It drives me crazy when they do stuff like that. But it's still an interesting, if slight, documentary, because I find him to be a fascinating American figure, like a kind of crucially, again, he is like a crucially American person in a bunch of different ways, not just the fact that he's an immigrant success story, comes to America, becomes a citizen in 1999, you know, which they don't really talk about at all, which I found kind of surprising. But whatever, he's an immigrant, comes to America from Austria by way of France. Starts working in kitchens in Los Angeles and is kind of horrified by the terrible quality of the food, and starts out as the chef at Ma Maison, and then of course opens Spago, and from there it's history. He's like the first, you know, huge. He's the first of like the modern wave of huge celebrity chefs, right? With his chains of restaurants and, you know, airport stands and freezer aisles and whatever. Again, I find this all very interesting, and I would have liked to have a lot more of it. I wanted to know more about the individual restaurants. I wanted to know more about how he puts together a menu. There's this really great moment where he's discussing the development of what I guess is kind of a signature dish at Spago, the salmon pizza,
the smoked salmon pizza.
With the caviar, and how that like came about, just like as it was like a moment of panic. He had a famous
Joan Collins
walks into the restaurant and she wants, you know, his brioche and smoked salmon, and he's out of brioche. She's like, "What am I gonna do? I don't know." So he makes this pizza. And it's very interesting, but I wanted more of that. I wanted to know more about the recipes. I wanted to know more about the fusion, like how he decides to put these things together, how the different styles work, how they complement each other, how they contrast with each other. I wanted more of his theory of food, if that makes sense. I wanted to know more about what he actually thinks about the actual ingredients of the food as he's putting them together. So look, it's an interesting documentary, but it's slight and it cares about stuff I don't care about, like his family and his childhood. I'm not trying to get the rosebud of Wolfgang Puck, right? I just want to know how he builds a restaurant and how he does what he does, because the celebrity angle of it is like kind of interesting, but pretty obvious. I mean, he's like a celebrity chef in Los Angeles, and he's rubbing elbows with movie stars, and he's getting on TV all the time. Like, that's not rocket science, and it's not frankly that interesting. It's the food that's interesting, and this doesn't have enough of it. So I'm very mixed on this movie. It is about an interesting person who I think is great. In a very, again, specific and American way, but the documentary itself is just kind of lacking. It's very on the surface.
Thank you.
That's all I got.
Thank you, Sonny. Did you see Chiro Dreams of Sushi?
I did, which I liked more, but that may just have been because it's more exotic.
Yeah.
And I knew even less about the subject.
A little bit of apples. Yeah, there's some things that they have in common, which is sort of the drive and the commitment, the passion, but two different, very different lives. One is monastic and the other one built an empire. But anyway.
Yeah.
JVL, you just saw this movie.
You turned it off moments before the show
Before the show. So I share almost all of your frustrations with the documentary, but I've been really looking forward to doing this show because I feel as though we have a resource sitting right here with us who probably is going to be able to answer all of the questions that we have.
I was going to say, finally, a movie that spoke to me, sir.
And so, I mean, I have one big question that I want to ask Vic later, but I disagree with you, Sonny, that it's all about the food. I don't think it's about the food. I think it is that he turned himself into an industry, and one of the things that I find interesting, there's a moment where he's walking through, it's footage of him walking through a Ralph's, you know, looking at the shelves. He says, "What am I? Am I a chef? Am I a character? Mm-hmm. Am I right?" And that's an excellent question. It's the only real moment of introspection about his career that the understand this
but
is a very this
like,
is all a sanctioned authorized piece.
Right.
So there is no, you know, there's nothing in this that that the wolf doesn't want himself to have in there.
But there is that introspection, except that it's immediately dismissed by every other talking head in the thing. You know, the other sous chefs and assistant chefs and those guys are all like, yeah, but he's a celebrity chef who can actually cook. Like, everyone is very clear on that.
Yeah,
he's like,
but his success is, I would say, certainly his later success is immaterial to his ability to cook. Because he's not, you know, his empire is so big. Like, what does he do? The shots of him walking through his kitchen saying, yeah, don't overburn this. You realize, seeing that, he has no control over what's going on there day to day. You know, like, this is just like the old man walking through. Yes, chef. You know, yes, chef. But the other thing that I want to just point out before we turn the show over to Vic is so much of his life feels like it is from a million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see him with Johnny Carson,
Bryant
Gumbel, Deborah Norville. These people who have been off stage in American life for 40 years, of them.
Uh-huh.
And
he's still around.
You know,
they're gone.
He was a famous guy and a comer then. Mm-hmm. And is still that guy now, and these people are just gone.
Longevity. That's very true.
The final thing I'll do, I the analogy I kept coming back to actually was Schwarzenegger. So Schwarzenegger is two years older than he is.
Fellow Austrian.
Both from Austria. And like the wolf, Schwarzenegger just had this drive to be famous. And he used this weird thing, bodybuilding, to turn himself into an industry and become famous. Mm-hmm. And that's what Puck did.
Mm-hmm.
He took this weird thing, cooking, and used it to turn himself into an industry. And I find that very interesting. With all that said,
driven.
Vic, just go.
I
want a total brain dump
no,
here.
No. Okay, so I gave it a documentary quadrant score, obviously, an A. Plot, I gave it an A minus, actually, because I wanted more. That's so funny you should say that. It was like, it skims the surface. I enjoyed it. I enjoy these kind of things. But you I could have had another, I don't know. I mean, think about how many documentaries or movies we've seen that were way too long. You know, I wish you could transplant like 30 minutes off of one of these shows that we had to go sit through and put it on this one. I mean, so you can dig deeper. And I gave it an A+ under sex and nudity because it's actually gastropornography. So if you get that, because it was great. You just want to sink your teeth into it. I
so
love a good
super
schnitzel.
Slow motion of them like stirring the sauces.
Oh, please.
You're sitting there like, money
that's
shot.
That's the stuff. Ugh. I passed out.
There's one shot kind of late in the movie where Wolfgang Puck is cooking and there's like a setting sun behind him and the like the flames and the smoke and stuff were all just mixed up in it. And it looked very good in 4K on my TV. and I was like, I could make 3 hours of this, the like background image on my TV when it goes to sleep, you know? Like I just wanted more of that. That's all I wanted.
He was very driven, as JVL says, coming from a very small town, Sankt Veit an der Glan, right? That's in Carinthia, or Carinthia. And Schwarzenegger was from the neighboring province, which is Asteria. But again, he starts off with, there's an interesting commonality he has with some chefs, which is growing up under terrible father figures. And for him, it's his stepfather. For Michel Richard, it was his father, who was an alcoholic, and then after he left the family and that was in divorce, then the stepfather came into Michel Richard's life, and then Michel had to leave. There was no room for him in the house, and he had nowhere to go. It was terrible. And then he went, you know, studied under a very, very difficult and abusive first chef who trained him. And then Eric Repair from Le Bernardin also had a very abusive stepfather who played all sorts of mind games with him. And then the same thing with Wolfgang Puck telling him that he's worthless. And you just the impact it has on kids. I don't know to the extent of the I'm going to jump off this bridge moment that they play up in the documentary. And Sonny, you're talking about this because this is all recreation when they do that. But what happens is he's in Villach at this small hotel, and he screws up because they run out of potatoes. And then he thinks about and then he gets fired. And so he's told in the kitchen that he's worthless, and he's told at home that he's worthless. I thought it was so remarkable, his story, that his only option in his mind was to come back the next day, even though he's fired, and just say, no, I'm staying. And somehow he lucks out. And then from there goes to Beaumont and then over to the United States. It's great. I mean, following, there was a time where, you know, it was the restaurateur who was the boss. And they bring this up in the documentary, because it was him versus Patrick Tallaire, I think his name is. Patrick Tallaire, who was at Mamaison, and he was the owner. And the feeling is, at the time in the 70s, you know, the restaurateur is he's the celebrity, he's a star, he's the one, and he was. And Tallaire was friends, he did business with all these famous people. And Wolfgang is great, but he's just a chef. And that goes way back to Le Pavillon, right? The first fancy French restaurant in New York City, which started after the World's Fair, and Henri Soleil was the proprietor. He was famous, and he was the face of the restaurant. And so that's still like a remnant of that. But clearly that changed. And I think part of it is because Wolfgang was very charismatic and people really liked him. And so when he goes to open up Spago, everybody goes with him. And the rest is history.
So can I break in here, Vic? Because so you hit on something that's very interesting. And I wonder if it is because of Wolfgang or if this was a shift which was going to happen no matter what. So this is all part of, I think it was Tyler Cowen who wrote the book about like the superstar class, mm-hmm. right? And about how, you know, we are seeing in all of the creative economies, the elevation of superstars, because it turns out the superstars have so much value that it makes them almost a different type of creature. And if that was going to happen with chefs at some point, because the truth is the restaurateurs were extracting more value than they added to the enterprises, and that this shift, which I think is now complete, right? I mean, every time I go, even, you know, down to the beach, the new fancy, you know, beach standard fancy restaurant is fronted by a chef. Like, this is I don't know who this guy is, but his name is the name that's on the thing. And it's not just a restaurateur. It's not an impresario. So this is one of my many questions I have for you, Victorino, was, do you think this shift was inevitable without Wolfgang, or was he just, or did it require him?
think it required to him to be at the right place and at the right time, Los Angeles, you know, and he happened to be at the hottest restaurant at the time, Mame-san. Because I'm trying and I'm struggling right now, and maybe listeners will have thoughts on this, but, you know, if not for him, what were the other restaurants at the time where
well,
they were developing?
Where is Michel Richard then? So at the same time that Wolfgang is at Mame-san, where is Michel Richard?
Gosh, he had he might have already been in the early 80s. Maybe by then he was at Citronelle in Georgetown. But he was an entirely different creature. I mean, he liked, for the longest time, was only on, you know, focused on several restaurants. He expanded and then he contracted and then, you know. But he was there. Daniel Boulou is another interesting character because he's a great French, one of the great French chefs. And he, much like Wolfgang Puck, but after, he's a few years behind Wolfgang because Wolfgang is older. Daniel Boulou was at Le Cirque in New York. And that was famously under the restaurateur Cirio Macchione. And it remained that way. And when Daniel Boulou left, Le Cirque was still a popular restaurant, you know, under Cirio. Everybody knows about it. I mean, but that's, you know, they had to serve. And there was always this, the tension between chef and owner. And then you start. And then until eventually the chef becomes the owner. And then that's, you know, they reach their perfection for them. But but that came later. So I think it's just a matter that he was the first. Wolfgang was the first. And then these others, chefs followed along the way. Same thing with, you know, I don't know, Eric Rappert at Le Bernardin, which is like, you know, the highest rated of all the French restaurants, I think, in New York. He started under Joël Robuchon, but he was a chef, an insane person in France. So I think a lot had to do with Wolfgang being who he was. And also, I mean, again, he was at the right place. But it is, you know, before he was there, I mean, clearly it was a popular restaurant, even though they were serving crap, right? I mean, everything was frozen. They said the food wasn't that great. Then it finally got a bad review.
So it says that everything was, it was popular, but was facing bankruptcy. So it wasn't actually profitable.
Right.
It was a place in decline.
And there are places like that. It's just, you know, everyone just goes there. I mean, people in D.C., people talk about Duke Ziebert's and the food was just okay, but you had to be there. You had to be seen there, you know.
Well, the French restaurant that he kind of studied at in France.
Yes.
They don't really talk about that very much at all. He's like in and out of
it
there.
It is, but it's in Provence and it's not. I don't know if you ask me, not that I've been there, but there are a lot more famous French restaurants out there. He went to, he studied in Dijon as well. You know, that's where, again, there was that connection with Dijon. But that's why he talks about wanting to work at Mame-san, because the Patrick Terrill was the nephew of the owner of Le Tour d'Argent, which is a big restaurant in France, you know, or Trois Gros. There's all these other big places, Le Pyramide at the time. But it was fine. You know, I mean, he learns a lot. Yeah, and that's the way to do it. And you go out there to France and you make your bones. You don't make anything. And then you work your way up. And he worked at, but there's a lot that they skip. Like Wolfgang worked at Maxime's, you know, lots of famous people worked at Maxime's in Paris. You know, Jacques Pepin worked at Maxime. So, but there's a lot that they do leave out. I'll tell you what they leave out, which is really sort of a dark story, is Mame-san, when Wolfgang was the chef, one of his underlings was John Sweeney. And when Wolfgang Puck moved and opened up Spago, Sweeney became the sous chef at Mame-san. And then he murdered the actress Dominic Dunne. Do you remember this, JVL or Sonny? It's a famous, right?
Is this the Black Dahlia murder?
No, this was like in 83, 84. It was shortly after. She was the actress from Poltergeist who was murdered. And the older daughter. And she is the daughter of Dominic Dunne and the niece of Joan Didion. But and this is how Dominic Dunne became, like, remember, he became this writer, I think, for Vanity Fair about bringing the killer to justice, because Sweeney got out like he was supposed to serve a long term, like 15 to life. And then he got out on a technicality after 3 years and he stabbed her to death. And then he opened up a restaurant And then people went to the restaurant. It was messed up. But anyway, that's like the dark side of. They don't talk about that.
They don't talk about this in the Disney Plus documentary.
Yeah, and they didn't ask, like, hey, how well did you know John Sweeney? You know, they didn't ask him that. Yeah. Apparently not, you know, not well. So, but they did. They sent him to France. Wolfgang sent John Sweeney to France to learn how to cook. But apparently, you know, he was very hot-headed and was very jealous. And there was that. The other thing they don't mention is that Puck was married three times, not twice. So you see her, his wife Barbara.
Was the first.
It was just like for a few, like for 4 years in France. You know, when he was in France, and then Barbara Lazaroff came later, and she's obviously the very important figure in his life, and then his current wife.
So here's a question. I feel like the documentary gave her quite a lot of credit, but maybe even not enough, because it seems as though the entire concept for Spago of trying to turn him into a star with an open kitchen, which treats it as a stage so that people will look at him, seems to have been her idea.
They make it seem that way. Or at least at the very least, it was a joint collaboration. And certainly she gets credit because she's got to raise the two kids at home too. And I mean, it's one of the interesting things is when they talk about where the son Byron, Puck says that just to have a family meal, you know, he had to eat at Spago's because it's the only time you see him. Yeah. And they say that. I mean, Michel Richards, he said that to me. It's like, you know, you feel bad when you're at the restaurant that you're not with your wife and kids, but you're married to the kitchen, you know. But a lot of these famous people, you know, cooking or not even in cooking in other areas, in the fields of celebrity, you know, that's the sacrifice you make for being famous. And you got to go all over the world. So it's very difficult. But, yeah.
It's how all of us feel about our work, right? I mean,
Vic, have you ever?
I'm totally kidding. I'm being totally serious. Don't you? I mean, you know, like when I'm not working, I feel guilty for not neglecting my kids, right? Oh, yeah. And when I'm with my kids, I feel guilty for not working.
Yeah. No, that's true. Sonny,
have you ever actually met Wolfgang Puck?
We had a lovely conversation on the phone, and it was for a piece I was doing
in Austrian.
A little bit. We were, you know, we just, you know how people, you ever see how people talk and they mix English and German or English and another language together just one time? I ended up doing that more and more in later years. It's just like it's just easier that way and they get what you, and they did it in the documentary where he's talking in some.
With his sister.
Oh, and I love listening to it because it is the thickest Austrian accents I've ever heard. So, for example, you know, in normal Hochdeutsch and normal German, you would say, if you say I'm hungry, right? You say ich habe Hunger, ich habe. And you, when he opens the door, it's a good thing they had the subtitle because he literally says, he goes, ich hob ein Hunger. Ich becomes E. Everything is E. Like, I hope, ich hoffe, you know? And so it's very funny to listen to that. But he called, it was very funny. I was working on a piece on steak sauces that, like, there was like all these places were having steak sauces suddenly, you know, on their menu. And isn't steak supposed to be so good you don't need to put it on with sauce? And Wolfgang has sauces on his menu. So, and it was a piece for the Washington Post. So you got a quick call back. And so I get the phone, I see the, and it's funny because the caller ID on the phone when I was at the Standard at the time, and it just said Spago's on it. So I knew that. And like it had the ID on it. And so I just answered. I said, Victor, you know, Victor Mattis. And then he just says, hello, Victor Mattis. It's Wolfgang Puck. And then off to the races. And I said, why? And I remember asking him, I said, why? So, like, you know, what is it about steak? Like, you know, like steak shouldn't need a sauce, right? And he said something to the effect of, like, yeah, it's like when a woman is so good looking, she doesn't need any clothes. But sometimes a little bit is okay. That's what he said. Sometimes a little bit is okay. And then he just admitted that he likes sauces. He went to Dijon. They love sauces, you know. But because it used to be that meat was so bad that you needed a good sauce. Like the French were so good with their sauces, you know, because to cover up bad meat. But now it's so good. But anyway, he was great and he was very helpful. And I talked to his, and I was going to Vienna and he was telling me what to do and what to eat. And we had a conversation about serving German food in his restaurants. And that's when he brought up the schnitzel, because of course he says, you know, that he does it at Spago's, the chicken schnitzel, but not Tafelspitz, which is another piece I was working on, which is boiled beef and things like that. But he was great. He was very helpful, you know, but he spends all this time. That's what he does. You know, he just spends time talking to people and doing all the stuff. So anyway,
So for something like this to happen, for this industry to happen, you need a confluence of things. You need more TV channels with more time to fill, right? Which, yes. Which then creates a demand side for celebrities, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the TV needs celebrities to put them on to fill airtime. You need a nationalization of cuisine, where we all start eating basically the same things. Mm-hmm. And you need to have somebody who is the first at it, the first to become the celebrity chef, right. Which is one of the weird things. Like, it ends with them, with Wolfgang saying, the show ends with Wolfgang saying, you know, now I have these hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people who want to go and become celebrity chefs like me. And mm-hmm. And I feel bad if this is what these people want, because you can't become this anymore, because he was the first, and that was the whole thing of it.
Right.
It's like, you can't become the next Arnold Schwarzenegger. You could become a famous person, but you have to do it in a different way than Schwarzenegger right. did. And you have to do it. You now have to do it like the way Rachel Ray did it, or which beats the fuck out of me. I don't know how Rachel Ray became Rachel Ray. But, you know, like, she's a famous person.
I would say also my favorite of all of them, is Giada.
Guy Fieri.
Is Giada. I wow. could watch her chopping, mincing, any sort of movement that involves
swaying
vibrations.
I don't know who this is.
You don't know Giada? Oh, come on. Giada De Laurentiis, who is, like, what is she, the granddaughter of Dino?
She has a relation to the great Dino De Laurentiis, the producer.
I love her.
So this, again, it's the same question but a different thing. Was it we were going to get somebody like this? Something like this? Was the celebrity chef going to happen?
I mean, yeah.
No matter
well, the
what,
celebrity chef, there, I think it's worth noting that the celebrity chef was already a thing before Wolfgang Puck.
Right, there were personalities like Julia yeah. Child. But Julia yeah. Child did not like run a restaurant, per se.
Right.
You know?
Right.
She was I'll tell you what's interesting in this movie is...
She was a celebrity author. Right. She was an author who went on TV.
She was. And but I'll tell you what's interesting.
She had her own show,
and I,
right?
Didn't
had,
you find interesting... Didn't you find interesting how... seemingly instrumental Mike Ovitz was mm-hmm. in this documentary from Disney Plus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like that's what he said. He said, I made him. That's what he said about.
Yeah. Well, this is a big, it is a story in Michael Ovitz's book, is that he like basically talks about how he made Wolfgang Puck household name is that he, you know,
yeah.
So I'm sure.
Well, this is, and yeah. TV is the key ingredient in all of this, right? You can't yes. you can't achieve the escape velocity required to become a celebrity chef without television. And that's why when I wanted to push back on the idea that it was about the food, I don't think it's about the food. I think it's about TV. And he was good on TV. And that's what turned him from a guy who ran a trendy restaurant in Hollywood into an industry. And there is, but which is a separate question from the cuisine question, yeah. where his influence seems to be very, very real. Unless I'm misreading yeah. this, Victor.
No, no,
the whole idea of California cuisine comes
Asian,
from him.
California cuisine, Asian fusion, and the open kitchen. You know, the open
but
kitchen.
Those
which,
are, yeah. yeah, so those are real
those
innovations.
Are real he did real things. And
which he ought to right. be more remembered. But this is so the tragedy of Wolfgang Puck is that he seems to be a guy so relentlessly moving forward because he thinks that he has to expand.
Yeah.
That he has lost sight of what it is he really wants to do and mm-hmm. why he's expanding. It's like watching a tech company that's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger without ever keeping focus on its core mission and core competencies. And that's what the industry of Wolfgang Puck looks like it did. And the thing doesn't take, you know, like those Wolfgang Puck cafes that were in like the Pentagon City Mall
Express.
And were at the airports, yeah. those things are all gone.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I don't think I see the pizzas very often anymore in the frozen pizza aisle, right?
I see the cans of soup, but I have to confess, maybe I've only got a couple times just because if I needed a, you know, a broth or a stock, you know, in a pinch or something like that. So it's a weird thing.
So there, you know, there have been backward steps, but this really shows the limitations of documentary as a form on Disney Plus, because Disney Plus is clearly not a place where anything that is remotely objective, let alone critical, can be done.
Yeah. Well, this is a thing that is designed to be shown at the Wolfgang Puck restaurant in Disney World.
Yeah.
You know, this is a thing that is meant to be playing on a loop while you're eating your Chinese chicken noodle salad. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
That's right. But yeah,
which is why it's frustrating. It's a I wanted so much more from this, because I just it's not a very good documentary, if I'm just being totally blunt. It is perfectly functional, but it is so surface level.
It's a love letter.
Yeah, not even.
I mean, they
like,
try
I,
to
I
be,
would,
but it's just very.
You know. I would like a love letter, like a genuine, deeply researched love letter would be sort of interesting. But he does seem like a guy who merits a serious documentary treatment.
Oh, sure.
Right? I mean, it's like you said, the contribution.
But as you said also, and I think that really is an important point, is that it was, you know, how TV and cable sort of revolutionized. And they show you clips of old cooking shows prior to, you know, Wolfgang Puck.
Yeah.
Let's say
the basic cable access.
There was one that was the first one they showed was like the old Cajun chef, this old man, and he's like with his Cajun accent. They were all on public television. That's the thing. They were all on public television. Jacques Pepin and Julia Child and Martin Yan and all these guys. But that the Cajun
because the
chef,
cost of programming was zero.
That. Yeah, right. It was just, you know. And then next thing you know, he is on. And then after that, of course, we forget about Emeril Lagasse, who took Celebrity Chef really to the next level at the time. And again, Emeril's old too. Emeril came from Commander's Palace in New Orleans. And then I recently saw him on TV, and it was one of those. It's like on a Sunday before actual programming happens on a main network. And so it's just an infomercial. And it was an infomercial for his, it was like a, I think it was like some sort of an air fryer that he was advertising for.
Yes.
And you know, with a, you know how they have, it's an infomercial with an audience, you know, in front of a live, in front of the live audience, so they can go ooh and ah. And he just does his thing and shows what you could put in the air fryer.
Bam.
So you look at this So this is what I mean when
leading.
You get to a point in life where you can do basically whatever you want to. Mm-hmm. What sort of guy says, I would rather be a pitch man, like the Bim or the Billy, the Oxy guy, the bearded Bill, what was his name?
Yeah,
I can't. You know, the famous pitch man. He died of stomach cancer like six years ago or something like that. I'd rather do that late in life, like Emeril Lagasse, than be standing up a new restaurant.
Right.
Right. And putting together a new menu and doing something interesting that scares me. Mm-hmm. That's a weird, it seems like people have lost track of why they do what they do.
Right.
I'm sure if you get
a paycheck, it's a good paycheck.
Saying like, I'm going to pay you $250,000 for you to cook for 2 hours on this air fryer.
Okay. But also there does come a point where you're beyond that. And it's different for different people at different levels, right? But where we are in our lives, if somebody came to us and said, I'd give you...
Here's $250,000 to cook with an air fryer, I'd be like, yes! Yeah, let's do it! Give me that money!
Here's $200 to come and write a piece about XYZ, something which doesn't interest us at all. Mm-hmm. We'd say no. No, I'm going to spend that time doing something I enjoy doing.
I don't know.
And when you have had a show on Food Network for 20 years and you have an entire line of cooking utensils and oven mitts and whatnot, I think that you probably don't need that $200,000 for doing the pitchman stuff, right?
Or, and you know what happens is they get too old and, you know, your contract expires and the Food Network no longer wants you because you're not young and a woman or, you know, an attractive. Then you know, then you got that you're gone, you know, and that's probably what happened with Emeril, you know, because he's old. Nobody wants old people on TV.
But again, this is a guy who wants to be on TV and not a guy who wants to be cooking. Yeah. Right. This is right. Yeah,
I guess. But it is, you know, I mean, talking about the menu and both of you.
Can we talk a little bit
his
about
idea,
the
his idea at end in life, like when he's at Spago, Spago's now at Beverly Hills, right? When he called me, it was Spago's Beverly Hills, and bringing like, what else I want to do? And he home cooking, the idea that he was going to cook Austrian food. What a great idea. And the chicken schnitzel, it's, I mean, you could do pork. That's what a lot of places do. Veal is the authentic, but it's too expensive, and people have issues with that, especially, you know, he's in California. So he does that, and just watching him, I mean, it's a great idea. And again, when I spoke to him, the only thing that he said he missed was the Viennese desserts or the Austrian desserts, which for some whatever reason he hasn't brought here, which are fantastic, but he didn't bother to bring that to his restaurants. They have other things. But yeah, it's, you know, I could have, a good 30 more minutes on that would have been great.
Can you actually just talk a little bit about how the fusion ideal has seeped into every other aspect of the restaurant industry? Because I do feel like it's kind of a weird thing taking all these different, you used to have French restaurants and Chinese restaurants and, you know, steakhouses. Yeah. And now everybody tries to do a little bit of everything.
Well, and we don't really think about it anymore because it just is. You know, when you have, I used to joke around that California Pizza Kitchen was, you know, like if you ordered their Thai pizza, they would just take, you know, Thai food from a restaurant and then dump it on top of the pizza. Here you go. There's your pizza for you. And that was it. Or their Mushu pizza. That's all they did. Just take the Mushu and put it on top. You know, I mean, obviously, Wolfgang put a lot of effort into, you know, thinking about how this is going to, and the Asian chicken salad isn't even really his idea, right? I mean, it was like prior to, people say that it was, you know, oh, what's her name, Marilyn Wu, or somebody from like 10, 20 years before that who had come up with it, but he made it more famous. Either way, he's at least partly responsible for that. I don't know. I mean, you think about it now, and, you know, it just is. Although I feel like we've, you know, we're constantly looking for the new. And so, I mean, like what happened to LA? Nobody talks about California cuisine anymore. You know, it's just not a thing. You know, and LA is no longer the city that it was in that sense, you know? So that was it. Before we go, Sonny, did you want to talk, but still staying on the topic of food, you had some issue about bread in a basket.
Oh, well, save that for the outtakes.
All right. We'll talk some more food at the end.
Yeah. Okay. Victorino, okay. I have two questions for you. Shoot. One, your friend Ruth Reichel?
Reichel. Yeah, Reichel, I never met her, but I read her.
But you
books.
Did read a book, but oh. You've read a book by her. I believe I heard on this podcast once that you read a book.
I read three of her books. I've read three of her books.
Yeah. And two, could you give me a ranking of the three worst celebrity chefs?
Oh, okay.
The three celebrity chefs you disdain the most.
I was not a fan of Sandra Lee. Neither was the late Anthony Bourdain. He used to say some really terrible things about her. She ended up becoming the girlfriend of Andrew Cuomo, I think. But just, you know, I mean, the stuff that she's putting together on the Food Network, if I recall, is not really appetizing stuff. You don't want to see, you know, it's just not great. It's hard for me to be put on the spot thinking about celebrity chefs I don't like. Besides
Chef Jeff,
if you were a celebrity, Sonny, maybe. Yeah, burn, sick burn. Anyway.
Okay, well, give me top three. Your three favorite celebrity chefs.
Danielle Ballou, who is great, and Eric Rappaire, who is also, I think, I have a bias with French chefs, and I like Michel Richard because I knew him the best, and you know I spent a lot of time with
him. Of these three celebrity chefs you just mentioned, correct me if I'm wrong, you have sat and eaten privately with all three of them.
No,
correct?
You know, I interviewed Eric for the Free Beacon actually, but did not. Dine with him, although he is very charming and attractive. And I'm just going to throw it out there. Bollywood is great. People, they're very generous with their time in terms of just talk, you know, in terms of just wanting to pick their brains about food. Oh, and Jacques Pepin. Ah, man, that's hard. He's great. And he's a legend, right? He goes back to, because he's very old now. He's in his 80s. And he was there at the same time with Julia Child. And he worked as he almost took a job at the White House to be White House chef for Kennedy. His friend did it. And instead he became the head chef or the corporate chef for Howard Johnson. Mr. Howard Johnson himself. And came up with the food, including he came up with a lobster roll for them. And that's what I got the idea to eat a lobster roll with Jacques Pepin, which was a great experience for me. The one thing he says, and people forget this, is in that movie, Julie and Julia, right? The one with
Julia Stiles.
Yeah.
Julia Stiles. So it was Meryl Streep.
Julia and Julia.
Yes, it was Meryl Streep and Amy Adams, and they toggle back and forth between the life of Julia Child and the other, who is not such a great person, based on her second book. I think it was called Cleaver or something like that. There's a scene in that movie where Amy Adams' character, the real Julia, is getting excited because of a famous food editor who was, I believe, Julia Child's editor, was going to come to dinner. And she was going to the blogger's home for dinner because she was a food blogger. And she's going to impress her. And she makes all this stuff. And in the movie, and I guess in the book, she doesn't make it over because she's not feeling well and it was raining. But Jacques Pepin told me that the truth is she had no desire to go to this woman's home. Because, you know, her loyalty lied with Julia Child. It's like, what are you trying to do here? So, anyway. And that's it.
This is the best show ever.
But it's, it's great. And so those are my favorites. I think, yeah, Jacques Pepin is up there. Balut is up there. And maybe Michelle. Michelle is nuts. Was nuts. He died. And sad. You know, there was a moment. You remember this. I was fuming. Mad with him because I was planning to do a book on him, and it was supposed to happen. And when I met with his publicist at the time, they told me that they had already promised, a book, or that he would do this with Bill Buford, the author who did Heat. And I thought that. I didn't know if they were lying, but I just didn't. It didn't sit well with me. But it turns out they were telling the truth because Buford did write the book Dirt, and there is a part of it with Michelle Richard, but it was just a chapter, and Buford took forever to write the book. So, I mean, honestly, you know.
Yeah.
That was unfortunate.
It's too bad. Would have the Vic Mattis.
I would have turned, you know, because I don't have that luxury like Bill Buford at the New Yorker where they, oh, you know, why don't you take 6 years and you could live in France away from your children, which is what he did. He had twins and he just left them.
It's like, I'm
not
out.
That I'm
That's
bitter
why
or anything.
He took 6 years, Vic.
Buford out.
He waited for them to be grown before he had to see the kids again. It was like, are you kidding me?
Is Centrale still there?
Yeah,
Centrale
is there. His protege became the chef there. He was very good. I think it's there. He made great fried chicken because Michel Richard, he fell in love with the old Kentucky Fried Chicken for the 1970s, not the one now, which is awful, but the original one, which is really, really bad for you, but delicious. And he made a great recipe for fried chicken at Centrale. And he shared with me the recipe. But I was so drunk, I don't remember it. Okay. Well.
Wow. The Vic Mattis story.
That's the story of my life, though. But it's the story of my life. Also, but he was, you know,
You should write a book about you. The first chapter is you forgetting the recipe, and then the last chapter is you recreating
it. I'm sure buttermilk was involved, maybe cornflakes. And I don't know about this part, but I'll share it anyway. You know, in the end, I was with Michelle, I think, maybe a month or less before he died. But by then, his faculties were not the same. But he was still there. So he'd have moments. He'd have moments of clarity. In between other moments where he'd like flick me on the head, you know, because he was mad at me or he was convinced I was talking about him. They get paranoid. And so you just have to like take the abuse. And then But then, like, the filter was gone. And so we were sitting outside outside his restaurant, and an attractive woman will come by, and he would just blurt out, boobs, boobs, like that. And, you know, I said, you're so lucky you have an excuse that you can say that. And I tried to do it myself. I tried to do it myself, but it didn't work out. Anyway, okay, let's move on. Corrections, shout-outs. I have a couple shout-outs. Congratulations to Subbeacon listener and friend Father Anthony Sharapa for celebrating 5 years as a priest. Congratulations.
Hey. Right. Yay, also, Father Anthony.
And also, thank you to friend and listener Robert Little, who sent me a desk set version of Cornhole. I just played that with my wife. It was great. See,
ooh.
Thank you. Thank you for the background.
Over the desk?
Over the desk, in and out. The shout-outs today were sacred and profane. Okay. That is all the time we're giving to this episode. Questions, comments, compliments, tweet us at Sunny Bunch, at Victorina Mattis. Again, be sure to subscribe to us on Patreon. Just go to subbeacon.com. We're there. Tell your friends. Until next time. Oh, go ahead. Talk about the breadbasket, Sonny.
Well, there was just this thing on.
Somebody
got lit up on Twitter because they were like, they put up a poll and it was like, should you eat bread immediately when it comes to the table, or should you wait a decent amount of time? And she was losing like 97% to 3%, and she followed it up with another tweet that was like, you should wait 5 minutes before you eat that bread. And I like everyone else was like, why on earth would you wait to eat the bread if the bread is still there after 5 minutes? Something has gone horribly wrong
with the bread
at your table.
What if the bread is warm? Like,
what if the bread is
moldy? Let it get cold?
Yes.
I don't understand.
It's not like popcorn. It's not like popcorn where some people wait for the movie to begin to start eating the popcorn. I know people do that versus like you sit down on, you know, by coming attractions is halfway done. Nowadays it depends. If it's just your typical bread basket, I might try to skip it altogether because, you know, I'm trying to cut back and I don't need it, you know.
Well, there's a reason. I mean, that's a reason not to.
That's
eat.
Right. There's a reason not for me. I'm like, oh, however, especially if it's like a nice restaurant where it's like something that's freshly baked, you got to have that bread.
Well, also different rules for different company, right? If the three of us are sitting down, that's one thing. If you are taking out to lunch a new person who is senior to you, who, you know, who you have not met before, and it's a new relationship, maybe you don't want to like dive in head first right away.
Oh, I would. You know what? Absolutely right. I would defer and let that person offer. Like, let them make the move. Would you like some bread?
Don't take before they do.
No. In fact, I might even lift the basket up and like nudge it. Over, like, huh?
Give me that basket of bread and a bottle of wine. Send it right over.
Sometimes they have like one of these big thin wafer things.
Garçon means boy.
Very nice reference. I know. Nice reference. One of those like fans of crusted bread, like that, like a thin wafer thing. Is it okay for me to snap it off, or do I just take the whole thing?
You gotta take the whole thing. If you're touching it, you got to take the whole thing.
All right.
Sorry.
All right.
What was your other thing, Victorino?
Okay. So when we were in Maine, we were exhausted from the first day. You fly in, blah, 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 and it was hot. We made it into this lovely cafe in Blue Hill called Sandy's Cafe, and it was lovely. And we're all sitting around and had a lovely waitress.
Oh, boy.
Her name was Melanie, and that's her real name. She's 22. And she comes from one of the massive Boston suburbs, but really cute. Got like a little nose, little earring, just a small one in the nose, just a small one. And I'm holding back so many other things I was going to say, but that's okay. Anyway, have a lovely conversation, chatting about where you know, like the whole deal. And she's so friendly and nice. And I'm just striking up a great conversation with my family in front of her.
Yeah, so, and she says, "Oh, your granddaughter is so adorable."
You don't even take it. Don't even take it away from me. So then, later, we're about to finish up lunch, and I am taking everybody's foods, you know, like, because I hate wasting, like, don't waste food. So I'm like, give me this and give me this.
The Mattis garbage disposal has
the vacuum
begun.
Has turned on. I'm like, bring it in. And so I'm...
I put my head back and I loosen my throat muscles.
So while it's happening, I can't believe you only had half of your, you know, wrap. Your wrap. I'm gonna eat the other half. And then Melanie shows up again. And, you know, to take out some of their tables. And she notices, of course, there are other food now on my plate that did not belong on the plate. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. And she goes, no. She says, I think that's adorable. My dad does that all the time.
That was the first time she called you daddy.
Oh, that's not fine.